sites after 21-year-old rapper Marvel FBG Woozkey Williams was shot. He also said officers also plan to hold community meetings to ease tensions. Five others were injured in the Monday afternoon shooting on the South Side, though none as seriously as Williams. He was in critical condition Monday going into surgery, but his condition was later upgraded to stable but serious. Williams was a friend of the rapper, whose funeral was being held in a church next to where the shooting occurred. In sports, in the NHL yesterday, Chicago beat Anaheim 3-1. The Red Sox took Game 1 of the World Series, beating the Dodgers last night 8-4. In the NBA this evening, Milwaukee hosts Philadelphia, and Charlotte is at Chicago. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Sunny skies over the next couple of days, highs in the low 50s. The next chance of some precipitation coming up on Friday. At that point, we have just a slight chance of some rain showers, a high around 51. For Saturday, a continuing chance of rain showers in the afternoon. For Sunday, a much better chance of rain, highs remaining in the low 50s. Right now, temperature reading of 36. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back, jackanddrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really happy to be sitting opposite this morning Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, Director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War, among other books, and a columnist whose work appears in newspapers across the country. And once a month he joins us here on WGTD's morning show to offer his perspective on various issues and concerns of the day. And Professor Sear, it's good to welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. It's a real tonic for me. It's a good way to start the day, and that's not true of every media encounter. So thank you very much for your positive and upbeat. You set the right example.
Well, we try. So let's talk first of all about something that occurred on the campus of Carthage College last night, and our listeners this morning have been hearing a few excerpts from a debate that was that took place in Carthage's Siebert Chapel between three contenders for the first congressional district seat about to be vacated by Paul Ryan. So we had on hand Republican Brian Steele and Democrat Randy Bryce and Independent Ken Yorgan for what sounds like a spirited debate. And I know that you were there. And I'm just curious to know from somebody who was in the room what it was like and your primary impressions from it.
Well, it was there was some acrimony among the candidates, but basically they respected the proprieties and everyone shook hands. The audience was very engaged, almost too much so. Our president, John Swallow, quite rightly mentioned at the start, don't be too disruptive and hold your applause. And Professor Roberg, one of the three moderators and someone who helped spearhead this great event for the college, mentioned that as well. But enthusiastic participants, nonetheless, were quite interventionist, but it was mostly with applause and cheers rather than catcalls and boos. And given the mean-spirited tone of our politics nowadays, in my view anyway, I thought that was very positive. President Swallow has continued a tradition that Greg Campbell, an earlier long-term president, who many of our listeners will remember, and you and I certainly do, this strong, sustained emphasis on community outreach, which is not only the right thing to do, but it's very, very smart and indeed increasingly essential in higher education, not just for us.
What seemed to be the liveliest issues that were talked about last night?
Well, people are very much interested in health care. Medical marijuana came up, of course, which is a kind of an issue du jour. But health care, a more long-term issue reflecting an aging population, which I certainly am mindful of, young man. The immigration issue was something that is very much a hot-button, hot-wire issue. I was impressed, since my trade is foreign policy, among other things, at how little attention we pay to any kind of specific discussion of foreign policy matters, compared to not so long ago in our country. And I think that was reflected in the debate. Our politicians reflect us, for better and worse.
Right.
And we're very much focused on ourselves in this country today. Mm. Not all bad.
Well, and it's certainly a good point, because whoever goes to Washington, well, whether it's Mr. Bryce or Mr. Stile or Mr. Yorgan, they're going to be confronting all kinds of issues related to foreign policy. And that needs to be in the mix as we get to know these candidates now. And even in their campaign ads, we see very little mention made of any issues even vaguely related to foreign policy. So the candidates themselves seem to be making the choice not to be talking much about that.
Yeah, and the candidates, anyone who lasts at all for any length of time in politics, they have to reflect the people and also lead the people in the best times. Money bills originate in the House of Representatives, and foreign policy, not just defense, costs money. They'll be addressing these matters. Mr. Bryce did mention the military. And Stiles, they both have their scripts, of course. And I thought of that in particular in listening to Mr. Stiles. The pro forma flag waving, thank you for your service, beating the drum for 1776, and a soundbite or two. You saw that reflected very much from my biased perspective.
Mm.
But the national government, they have the legal right to kill you and send you into harm's way, as do state governments in our system. That's where the nation state is really important, and I'm glad they at least touched on that.
Hmm. Speaking of sound bites, our general manager David Cole was there last
night.
Yes,
indeed,
and he shared some excerpts during our newscast.
Right.
He has a particularly entertaining soundbite from Mr. Yorgan that he thought would be fun for me to play. And this is Mr. Yorgan talking about
third-party independent candidate.
Yes. And I'm not absolutely certain of this, but I'm pretty certain that of the major debate events concerning the 1st Congressional District race, this may have been the only debate where he was invited to be part of it.
But glad he was.
It sounds like he was a lively contributor. Here's
he was.
Here's what he had to say, at least in part, about some of the tax reforms of President Trump.
It was a big, wet, sloppy kiss for the big boys at the top, and a little peck on the cheek for the middle class. Not only that, but they're going to come and wipe your cheek over the next 10 years, so there's no evidence of that little kiss. The tax structure needs to be redone. I mean, and those tax cuts for the big boys, those were permanent. Of course, we know nothing's permanent, so if you send me to Congress, I'll talk about that.
So, and that was independent candidate Ken Yorgan weighing in on taxes. But it points to a couple of things, and one of them is that sometimes a third-party candidate or independent candidate can be kind of an interesting catalyst.
Yes, indeed. And the conventional wisdom, which happens to be true in this case, is that third parties originate ideas adopted by the other major parties. For all the negative discussion in various quarters about the state of our politics today, it's interesting that there's no really significant third-party movement in the U.S. The last was Ross Perot in the 1990s, I think. And if we are in serious trouble, meaning the current organizations are not doing the job in terms of what a lot of people think, feel, and consequently act in the voting booth, there will be a third party movement. We'll just have to see.
So we have midterm elections coming up. Of course, they are of enormous consequence. What is your sense of what is ahead?
Well, you're always very nice to ask, and I regularly remind myself as well as you and our listeners. I'm a professor partly because I'm very good at predicting the past, and I'm regularly surprised. I've been around long enough to know this about the future. But I do pay attention to polls, and it looks like the Democrats have a good chance of capturing the House, though probably not by much, so we'll have Nancy Pelosi back again. I think there's a good chance that the Republicans will be able to hold on to the Senate. And with a couple of exceptions, early in the Great Depression being one of them, the party that has the White House usually does lose some ground in the off-year elections. President Trump, like President Obama, has a distinctive constituency, and it's undeniable, with nothing further implied, that African-American voters who came out strenuously, quite understandably for President Obama in the presidential years, did not come out in the off years. Again, it's undeniable and nothing further implied. An awful lot of people who voted for President Trump do not participate much in our politics. And despite his strenuous campaigning, which he, of course, loves to do, and you should, and it's probably necessary if you're going to be president, I will see if he's able to energize the base, as they say in the trade.
A lot rides on that.
And, that's right.
Yeah, we should mention that the day after the election, political science professors Jeff Roberg and Jerry Mast will be right here, sitting where you are, to offer their analysis.
Well, that's great. Two great colleagues in the political science department. Let me bring up Yuri Maltsev, who has a different point of view, is in the economics department, but another one of our fine colleagues who is more conservative on the spectrum. Jeff and Jerry would not be described as conservative. I really want to applaud again on the air, as I do so often off the air, your efforts to have, serious efforts to have political diversity on this particular NPR program.
Yeah, we really try to do that. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, and this is his monthly visit to the program. Of course, what has been creating major headlines over the last several weeks involves the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, reporter for The Washington Post, murdered in Istanbul in early October, in the Saudi consulate.
And murder is the right word.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. For a while, we didn't know exactly what had happened, and now it's becoming, of course, quite clear.
Yeah, if you take Professor Roberg's very fine international relations class, which I would love to do, you hear about realism and you hear about more liberal approaches in the Wilsonian sense. You hear lots of terms. We may have to have a Tony Soprano school of international relations added to the mix, given the apparent behavior of the Saudi government
right.
and this brutal and mafia-like killing.
Right. And, of course, what was especially interesting was to follow the shifting stories out of the Saudi
incredible.
Government.
Incredible. Just absurd. It shows how limited dictatorships really are. The kind of antics that are reminiscent of what communist governments did, what the Third Reich did on a regular basis for all their energy and dedication and intelligence. The ham-handed and clumsy efforts of dictatorial regimes, whether it's the old-time mafia or a modern-style dictatorship. It's just amazing, isn't it?
Right.
That these people have been so clumsy and ham-handed. It's a function of arrogance and hubris.
Hmm.
That's what it is.
Right.
And democracy at least undercuts that at the top.
Right. So in other words, when you are a dictator...
Just disgusting.
Right. And when you're a dictator, you feel as though you can do anything and you can get away with anything.
Right.
And it doesn't sort of matter what your story is. And I thought it was interesting that President Trump called this... the worst cover-up in world history or something like that. I mean, you spoke in those...
It's characteristic understatement.
Right.
Usual low-key.
But there's some real truth there. There's some real truth there in that it really was poorly conceived cover stories that sort of shifted by the day. And, of course, it has been interesting to see what has also been said by the Turkish government, who of course have been instrumental in the investigation of this incident. So what does this say about our relations with Saudi Arabia, for instance, and for that matter, our relations with Turkey? And where do you see all of this ending?
Well, it's a good reminder of how nice it is to deal with the Canadians, isn't it? Every U.S. president in modern times, by tradition, until the current chief executive, President Trump, would go to Canada, and those trips weren't always benign and positive. President Kennedy had some real problems with Prime Minister Diefenbaker, and they continued, for instance. But going to Saudi Arabia is your first overseas trip, I think, in hindsight, and even at the time, that's not a good idea. They're important allies of ours in a sense. In other ways, they're not, and you shouldn't be highlighting this particular regime in global terms. And that's not just 20/20 hindsight.
Right. And, of course, one of the, although my understanding is that America has revoked the visas of a number of Saudis believed to have been involved in some way in this killing, at the moment the call for the cutting off of arms sales to Saudi Arabia is being rebuffed by the Trump administration.
You're referring to cutting off of arms sales, not cutting off of arms.
Right.
Yes, another big distinction to be made in this context.
Right, right. So it will be interesting to see. In the very strongly worded remarks of Turkish President Erdogan, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Mohammed Salman, was not mentioned by name, but many, many people are pointing the finger at him as perhaps being the chief instigator of this murder. What can you tell us about him, and what would you predict about his future?
He's still in his 30s. He's risen to the top very, very quickly, of course, in the right family. Henry Kissinger was once heard to say, and now quite famously, Saudi Arabia isn't really a country. It's a very rich family surrounded by a lot of sand and oil and foreign workers and mercenaries. That remains true. It's a very fragile regime. And I think one of the most important points that isn't made much on the media or in public debate is the alternative to this regime is not some sort of Saudi Barack Obama. We're not going to replace, if we do quite unwisely seek to overthrow or make a change in this particular government, it's not going to be some kind of liberal Democrat in our terms. That's an extremely important point to make because during the long bloody war in Syria, serious people in our State Department talked and tried to act during the Obama administration as though if we could just get rid of the Assad regime, things will be better. We'll find some kind of liberal regime. Many years ago during the Carter administration, we were instrumental in distancing ourselves from Iran. And of course, when the Shah, who in some ways was a very ugly, though effective leader, went down, we did not get liberal Democrats. We did not get an Iranian version of Jimmy Carter. We got the fundamentalist regime we still struggle to cope with today, we should be very careful about how much we can influence events and whether they'll go our way. The most important argument for not embracing the Saudis the way President Trump has done since before he went to the White House is that you should keep your distance. We've got to deal with these people, and with a few exceptions, like our British and Australian friends and South Koreans and a few others, and the Japanese today and Germans, with most of the countries in the world, we want to be careful about trying to effectuate change, and a nice version of us is not going to happen if the regime goes down.
Right. That's a kind of an absurd assumption for us to make.
Yes, it is absurd, but serious people believe that, and especially when the Democrats are in office. It's an unfortunate tendency historically as well as current. Sorry to go on at such length, but when you look at our serious missteps since World War II and before, but especially since the war, that's the kind of thing that gets us in trouble.
Interesting. I just mentioned Turkish President Erdogan, and there was an important meeting between him and German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
Yes, indeed.
And you wrote about this and about the relationship between these two countries, who are very, very significant players in that part of the world in a couple of different ways. What can you tell us about this sort of mini summit between President Erdogan and Chancellor Merkel, and why does it matter so much in your mind?
Well, she publicly, in effect, embarrassed him, and I'm glad she did. In this case, it makes sense, at least the way she did it, without specifically criticizing or insulting him, face-to-face or otherwise. She did, in his presence, emphasize the importance of human rights, respect for human rights, respect for the law. And given Turkey's abysmal human rights record under Erdogan, they've been backpedaling, not toward strict dictatorship, but it's an increasingly autocratic regime. They have more journalists imprisoned in Turkey than any other country in the world, I believe. She was quite right to criticize him. Historically, Germany and Turkey are very, very close, emotionally more than politically. They both have a very strong military tradition. Historically, both countries, you don't want to mess with them in military terms if you can help it. They were close allies in the First World War. The Turks were sensible enough to keep their distance from Hitler and the Third Reich during the Second World War, and then came in during the last year of the war on the side of the Allies. I went to Turkey once, about 20 years ago. I actually would like to go back, despite all our problems. It's a country where the people are very friendly, rather like Russia. The Turk in the street is very friendly and positive toward the United States.
Huh.
Important military allies of ours, and it's important to keep that in mind. They've had top command as well as combat positions in Afghanistan. They're the right kind of ally to have. They were vital during the Gulf War. President George H.W. Bush and President Turgut Özal in Turkey had a close personal relationship, as Bush did with a remarkable number of leaders around the world well before he became vice president. They were strong allies of ours in the Korean War. It's extremely important to keep this national security dimension in mind. Again, we should not be so emotional about diplomacy, especially look to where our interests are and which countries are important to those interests. In Turkey, for all the downside, whatever we can do to maintain friendly relations with Turkey, we should do. Erdogan has been very public, as you indicated, criticizing the Saudi regime. I think he would very much like the prince to go down. In Saudi Arabia, Turkey wants to be the regional leader in the Middle East, and there is something of a competitive relationship, as I understand the complicated politics between Saudi Arabia and Turkey at the top, two distinctive Sunni regimes, but the resources and strength that Turkey has, despite Erdogan's economic mismanagement, it remains a very strong player in the region.
Interesting.
Well, I'm glad it is interesting, because so much of our media commentary is so superficial, and we understand why the candidates last night didn't talk about foreign policy, but I'm vexed by the fact that we pay so little attention to what's going on in the world, including the fact that Russian and American troops have been in combat in Syria. Let me repeat that. Russian and American forces have engaged in armed combat in Syria. It didn't escalate, but we just sort of blithely passed this stuff off.
Right. It's interesting what crowds it off the front page.
Yes, indeed.
Let's talk about, just for a moment, German Chancellor Angela Merkel. There were recently elections in Germany that did not exactly go her way. I mean, she's still in office, still in power, but there are political forces within Germany that with which she is at odds, and some of that opposition to some of her policies seems to be growing in significance. What is sort of her current political state of affairs at the moment?
Well, she's always on kind of shaky ground, but I think that's been true throughout her very lengthy career at the top. She clearly is very adept at, without being obviously or crudely public about it or direct, she's very good at limiting and at times undercutting rising rivals, younger politicians within her own CDU, CSU. There is no clearly unified opposition to the CDU, CSU. She has very strong nationalist, factions in her own party who are very upset about what they see as excessively liberal, tolerant policies that she's pursued regarding immigration especially. She's kept the right wing under control in her own party. I continue to believe the Germans are collectively in total, are absolutely terrified of the idea of a return of the far right. And even though generally in Europe, including in Germany, the far right has been gaining ground, I don't think, we were discussing this off the air, I don't think that's going to happen in Germany. I think if she's as wise as she's been so far, at some point she'll step down in the next several years. I think there, in her case, there's a danger of staying on too long. Winston Churchill said every political career ends in failure, and in his case, he failed a number of times before he succeeded. But then the conservatives were voted out of office even before the end of World War II. You've got to know when to go, whether you're a CEO or head of another organization or a very successful politician in our democratic system. But I'm a great fan of hers. I think she's been the ideal leader for the post-Cold War Germany.
Your mention of the rising of nationalist factions in Germany reminds me of President Trump earlier this week proudly labeling himself a nationalist. And of course, that's a term that can be interpreted in a lot of different ways, but he is saying something about himself that that his base really deeply admires. I mean, and by and large, that is who they are as well. That's a term that probably very well describes their priorities and what is most important to them.
Yes, I think that's true. You're absolutely right. It's an emphasis on nationalism and old-fashioned tub-thumping patriotism.
Let's talk about Britain and what they are experiencing right now. And in one of your most recent columns, you pointed, first of all, to very significant demonstrations in the streets from protesters demanding a second referendum on Brexit. Mm-hmm. And I would really like to hear more about exactly what they are asking for and hoping for, but then give you a chance to talk about really the main point of your column, which was about something that didn't garner nearly as much attention, a speech given by someone who's been very involved in national security in Britain with their organization M16, talking about what Brexit means in terms that don't get talked about enough, namely the national security. But tell us more about these demonstrations and what has prompted them.
Well, the organizers estimate that 700,000 people were in the streets of London. That's probably an exaggeration, but not by much. It seemed like the whole city was jammed, according to news reports. The good London police force would not come up with a specific estimate, but I think it's reasonable to estimate that somewhere around 500,000 people turned out. As is the case with our British friends in modern times, it nonetheless was a very peaceful demonstration. But it reflects the groundswell of sentiment that there really we really should remain in the European Union. A referendum in 2016 just barely voted in favor of leaving the European Union. It was a miscalculation by the Conservative government at that time. And since then, the Conservative government now in power under Theresa May has been very consistent in trying to negotiate a departure from the European Union, but they're tangled up in the details. Mm. Her own cabinet has been highly divided. There's been some very very prominent resignations from the government, and this popular demonstration reflected growing sentiment that if a deal is in fact worked out and the deadline is approaching with Brussels, that there really should be another popular vote, another public referendum on the subject. And that was the point of the demonstration.
Is there any possibility of that?
Yes, I think there's a very real possibility of that. Hmm. The British and others like to talk about muddling through. They often seem to be ineffective because they're not given historically to decisive moves on their own part. But their system does work. It's very durable. And a kind of pragmatic struggle characterizes British politics, especially with the fading of intense class conflict during the 20th century. That's my opinion. You should make up your own opinion, but if they seem to be totally fouled up, that's not true.
Hmm. So what is this other concern about Brexit beyond kind of the economic ramifications, that's what everybody talks about, this matter of how British national security could be severely hurt by Britain withdrawing from the European Union?
That's the other big news story. October 20 was the giant demonstration. The day before, on the 19th, John Sawyer's retired head of MI6, that's the foreign security branch, MI5, is domestic security in Britain for understandable reasons of maintaining a democratic system. The British have been very sensitive, more sensitive than we've been historically, about the fact that overseas intelligence should be kept out of our domestic affairs. But it was MI6 that he headed. Sir John Dearlove, another retired head of a British intelligence service, said a couple of years ago, when Theresa May was still Home Secretary, that withdrawing from the European Union won't have significant security implications. And several other British officials immediately responded, yes, it does. She was Home Secretary at the time and said, in terms of sharing police records, in terms of ready availability of information on transnational crime, actually withdrawing from the EU will be a problem for us. The point was also made that the border between there's been a peace agreement, which Prime Minister Tony Blair worked out just before the turn of the century, the last Labour Prime Minister, next to the last Labour Prime Minister, and a dominant figure for many years. The peace agreement finally ended the bitter and vicious conflict between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland, which is a really, really tragic story and has been the subject of tragic drama and melodramas for more than a century. The peace agreement has worked, but free-flowing trade and movement of people has been vital to that. Britain and Ireland are both in the European Union. If Britain leaves the EU, there is a real risk of a hard border between Northern Ireland and the rest of Ireland being reestablished. And that could ignite, spark renewed killing and renewal by the IRA. The British handled, from the 60s, the IRA had a kind of resurgence, the radical violent, fanatical wing of the IRA, and it was not enormous casualties in war terms, but a lot of brutal targeted killings. The British Army, which is extremely expert in counterinsurgency, along with good British government policies generally, managed to put a damper on this, in part by murder, by killing, decapitating the IRA by targeted killings of their most influential leaders in Northern Ireland and elsewhere. The British sense of targeted counterinsurgency is something I think we can learn a lot from still, and that accounts, along with very, very shrewd diplomacy and working out this peace agreement. But it's only been in place for 20 years. There's a very real danger of reigniting Northern Ireland, really cruel violence, given the way it affects poor families beyond the combatants in that still kind of troubled area. And that's the sticking point. If you look into the weeds of these negotiations between London and Brussels, Northern Ireland is a big sticking point. And I think ultimately, if the British remain in the EU, which I think they should do, that'll be a big factor. I got an article published in Parameters, the Journal of the U.S. Army War College, this year. It was not easy to do, but it was comparing and contrasting our approach to counterinsurgency with the British approach. So it's something I actually know something about. It's not easy to get published in Parameters. I can testify to that.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, real or die. It's only about 11 pages long, but I got, even after it was accepted, I got 100 pages of single-space commentary from various army officers. Yeah, well, there's a political dimension beyond the usual ordeal of trying to get academics to accept your point of view.
Right. So when you say that we have something to learn from the Britons,
they did not escalate firepower as we have done in Vietnam and elsewhere. They did not see the answer as sending in more Americans, whether it's in corporate life or military life. More is better, and we'll send in more troops and more firepower, and we'll escalate. And we tend to look at killing as an end in itself. At least during Vietnam, we did. And it's extremely important to avoid that point of view.
Right. And that certainly would be tragic if Brexit ends up holding and this ends up being one of the ramifications of
it. Well, muddling through, they will work it out, even though they don't seem to. You know, it's very easy to criticize our British friends, and we love to do it. But they're very effective, actually, at pragmatically working things out, more than other people, including us and the rest of Europe, historically.
Right. So, well, it'll certainly be interesting to see.
It's worth following. It really is.
And to see if a second referendum occurs. And, of course, it's also going to be interesting to see what ultimately happens with Prime Minister Theresa May. I mean, is she going to survive all of this? She seems to be on shaky ground at the
moment. Yes, and has been throughout. No, it's easy to criticize. She doesn't seem to be a consensus builder. She's part of a generation that went into Parliament in 1997 of, at the time, younger conservatives. The party historically, thanks to Harold Macmillan in the 50s and early 60s, is committed to Europe, but not anymore. These younger Tories just had a kind of emotional hostility to Europe that has played out in public policy terms. The other point of Sir John Sawyer's speech, and he was quite devastating, was that we're weaker in the world because we're separating ourselves from Europe and the Americans are separating themselves from us. He was absolutely devastating and, I believe, accurate in criticizing the Trump White House and the administration at the top for an indifference and a kind of crude, counterproductive approach of simply insulting foreigners. It's worth looking at the speech. It was at the Edward Heath Society. Edward Heath was Home Secretary and Prime Minister who finally got Britain into Europe, I believe, an undervalued Prime Minister. As the British are wont to do, they have a very nice society that honors him. The meeting was held in Salisbury, where a former double agent, Russian gentleman, and his daughter were poisoned by Russian agents in March. And Sir John made the point. Russians wouldn't do this in the streets of Germany or in the streets of America. They do it here because we're weaker. They're arrogant. Their killer instincts are freer in our country than in other countries.
Right.
Worth reading. This man is like other British intelligence pros. He's really very, very smart.
You one of the best lines in that column, I thought, was, I think you were paraphrasing his comments here. He said, Britain's isolation invites attack.
Yes. Well, there you summed it up quite right.
And
yeah.
It's so interesting to think about that because, of course, I think most isolationists believe that isolation makes sense exactly because it will give us more security. It will make us safer because, you know, we will not be getting entangled in the affairs of other places, and we'll tend to our own concerns and protect ourselves and so on. But in that act of isolation, at least in the world in which we live now, in fact, it's possible that you make yourself more vulnerable, not less.
During the last year of the terrible combat in Europe during World War II, Western Allied commanders were puzzling about how to deal with these huge German fortifications at Verdun and Metz. An effort to emulate the First World War, and General Patton quite rightly dismissed them as saying, fixed fortifications are monuments to the stupidity of man. When we've overcome oceans, we've overcome mountain ranges to run this war. Fixed fortifications are utterly absurd and give you a false sense of security, and that imagery applies to just about every aspect of life today. You've got to be prepared for movement.
Interesting.
If you want to survive.
Absolutely. I think most of us do.
Yeah, and we're talking about basically the economy and politics today. We're not talking about war in those kind of sizable terms.
Right. I believe it was since your last visit that that a meeting took place, I guess one might call it a summit of sorts, between the leaders of North and South Korea, and you wrote about this. And in particular, I thought, wrote in really interesting fashion about the attitudes of the current South Korean president, Moon Jae-in,
am I correct?
Yeah. And about the undeniably realistic terms in which Moon Jae-in regards North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think because of kind of a personal history. Can you just expound on that?
Yes, indeed. We've been talking about leaders who aren't so positive. To me, he's an extraordinarily impressive, positive person, as are other South Korean leaders today, women as well as men increasingly, though not the previous president, who is a woman, is currently in jail. He was a victim of the Park Chung-hee dictatorship, a very brutal dictatorship from the 60s to the end of the 70s. He was a human rights lawyer who was arrested, but he also was a... he served in the Korean Army Special Forces and had some combat experience around the DMZ. South Korea is a particularly important and vital ally of the United States, and I think that combination of experience plus his very flexible and, I think, realistic and effective approach to leadership means more than in other parts of the world we should be deferring to South Korea. We tend to talk... not just President Trump, but we tend to talk historically like we are somehow the principal player in the Korean Peninsula. That's never been the case, and we should be doing everything we can to emphasize the importance of the indigenous leadership. In many ways, the most important ally, I argue in that book you were nice enough to cite, it's the British and the South Koreans who are really pivotal for us in security terms in each region, and I truly believe that. There's a lot, the South Koreans have accomplished their great success since the Korean War, but we've played a vital role, and with Truman and then Eisenhower, there's a lot for Americans to feel very happy about, that we have handled the situation in Korea as wisely as we have. Just a remarkable success story. And to me, he's a truly heroic figure.
Interesting. President Trump and Vladimir Putin have announced that they are likely going to be meeting in Paris.
How nice.
What do you think is up with that?
Well, I think it's nice to see Paris. Perhaps they'll meet in the springtime. I think an old recording of Maurice Chevalier singing I Love Paris in the Springtime, that would be wonderful.
Okay. And that's all you have to say.
I think President Moon provides a great example. I think President Putin is impressive in the sense that he's on a very weak economic platform. But it's extraordinary. The main player external player in the Middle East today we've been discussing. We started discussing this, is Russia. Russia put together a summit involving leaders of Iran and Turkey, traditional enemies. Russia has, Putin's worked out a rapprochement with the Prime Minister of Israel, just extraordinary. They have replaced the United States of America throughout the region, especially in the current administration. George H.W. Bush and his Secretary of State, James Baker, after the very successful, brilliantly executed Gulf War, thank God brilliantly executed in 1991, they put together a comprehensive diplomatic effort that led to a Palestinian state that confirmed the U.S. as the dominant player in the region, not just regarding Israel, but region-wide. That was only a quarter of a century ago. Today, we account for nothing. I'm not exaggerating. Nothing, except for arms sales and occasional bombastic statements. Putin, despite all the weaknesses of his system, he must have endless energy as well as extraordinary intelligence to be as effective as he's been so far for so long. That's what I think.
Right. That's why you're here. We want to know what you think. We just have a couple of minutes left. I think what I want to focus on is that you wrote not too long ago about the big economic crash of 2008, so 10 years ago.
Yes.
And I wonder how you would compare our economic state of affairs now versus where we were in 2008 in a very, very scary place.
Yeah, I don't think we're returning to that place. But again, I'm very good at dealing with the past, not the future. The structure of the international financial system has survived. The way in which we return from disaster, and it really was that, a crisis that began in the United States, is a good case study in how to handle future crises, because there will be future crises. The end of the 20th century, and starting in 1997, there was a remarkably quick financial crash that turned into a general recession and set the stage for the dot-com crash in the U.S. I think what's going on in China now may well be a good precedent if we're looking to what might happen in the future. It's more like the crash of 97, 98 in Asia than the American-initiated, then global crash of 2008-9. If you're really interested in getting into the weeds in this subject, there's something called the Basel Accords, B-A-S-L-E. Big-time bankers and government officials get together in Switzerland and elsewhere to try to coordinate national regulations. The big commercial banks are more reined in than they were before, when we had really casino finance and casino capitalism before the 2007-8 collapse. And those regulations, I think, will make a difference the next time around. I also very much support the Volcker Rule, reflected in the Dodd-Frank legislation during the last crisis of a decade ago, forcing commercial banks to separate their trading from their customary deposit management is extremely important. Dodd-Frank was an effort to put in place the regulations of the New Deal concerning banks. I'm very sorry that banks have been able to water down those regulations. The fact that commercial bankers complain so much about them, I think, is an indication that they really are a good regulation, and that's something to pay attention to.
Right.
Paul Volcker was a good friend of Tom Clawson's, I might emphasize, and Volcker spoke at the opening of the Clawson Center only because of that close personal relationship. All bankers should not be painted with the same brush. There are a lot of very fine and effective finance executives, but regulation of the commercial banks and also regulation of the derivatives market is what to pay attention to. I don't think we're on the verge of another crisis of a decade ago.
Well, on that encouraging note, that's where we have to finish things out today. And I look forward to more conversations with you.
Well, thank
These
you.
Are always great encounters, and I appreciate your your thoughtful reflection on so many topics. So
well, thank you, Greg. It's good for me, too. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, President Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, with his monthly visit to the show. On Friday, John Eisenberg weighing in on the first season of Vince Lombardi as coach of the Green Bay Packers.